Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisby.
I'm Kirsty Dill.
And this is the podcast about reading books at the right time. Kirsty, what have you been reading on time this week?
Another audiobook. It's been very audiobook heavy recently. But I have been listening to Feminar, A New History of the Middle Ages, and Through the Women Written Out of It, by Yanina Ramirez, who is a historian, art and cultural historian at Oxford University. And she's also done some stuff on TV, so which is where I because I'm not a historian at all, and I know very little about the medieval time, but I followed Yanina Ramirez online for ages because she's a goth, which is very superficial of me, but I just think she's really cool. and I'm interested in feminist history and history, sort of reclaiming women from history that have been written out, and this is exactly this. So she takes this, the book's broken down into chapters that are things like, you know, art and political, you know, movers and shakers and religious leaders and you know, warriors and stuff like that, and talks about women who have been written out of history, basically. And it's using various things, you know, archival research, but also sort of research on manuscripts, you know, kind of massive technical leaps that have been made in being able to analyze documentation and archaeology and stuff like that. And some of the women that are talked about in the book, people may well have heard of, you know, Marjorie Kemp's probably the most famous woman that was talked about. But there's also people like Hildegard of Bingen. There were, you know, the Loftus Princess, which was an archaeological find that starts giving clues about actually how Christianity began in Europe, you know, and it's a woman at the centre of that. And also the chapter that I found most interesting was centred around the Bayeux Tapestry, which, I mean, lots of us know a little bit about, basically, and we know about it as this sort of document, a kind of living document almost of political and historical note. But of course, it was women who actually embroidered the tapestry, and those women have been lost to history, and this is about putting those women back in the history. And through that, also sort of highlighting quote unquote women's arts, you know, the kind of giving things like embroidery and handcrafts the kind of cultural value that they deserve. And also a bit that I found really interesting was around sort of gender variance and what they can tell from grave goods and the way that people were buried and what they were buried with, and, you know, kind of male skeletons with kind of feminine accompaniment, or female skeletons that were buried in the same way that warriors were buried. And you know, she says at one point, you know, there was legislation against women dressing too masculine, and if there was legislation against it, then it must have been a big enough problem that, you know, they wanted to stop it happening. So it was obviously, you know, a thing, as was men with long hair, you know. So these ideas that we have around gender presentation and stuff and gender variants are by no means new. So just even coming to it sort of completely cold, as it were, about medieval history, I found it completely fascinating. And I really recommend it. It's not, even if you're not a kind of habitual reader of big history books, it's not intimidating. I mean, as I said, I listened to the audiobook, which is narrated by Yanina Ramirez, and she's brilliant. So yes, I strongly recommend it, even if you're not a kind of habitual history reader.
I'd never even heard of this, and I'm not really a history reader, so that probably like puts it in there. But I love Marjorie Kemp. So we did her autobiography, or the book of Marjorie Kemp, as part of my degree. And I was the only person in my seminar that had read it cover to cover. I was fascinated with her. And I've since discovered from being online that I am not the only woman who's got a bit of a fascination with Marjorie Kemp. Like, she's a bit of a thing in certain circles. So bits of that sound really interesting. even though it's not the sort of thing that I'd go looking for.
Yeah, if it had not been Yanina Ramirez, I wouldn't have picked it up. I picked it up because I think she's really cool. So I would recommend it. I think you'd really like it, actually.
Yeah, I do like stuff about like women's stories being brought to the forefront or put back into history, because so much of it's gone missing, deliberately gone missing.
Yeah, well, this is what the title Feminar comes from, the way that women writers were denoted in manuscripts when sort of various gatekeepers were going through and sort of pulling stuff out that we didn't need to keep, you know, didn't need to keep, quote unquote. The way that women authors were denoted was to have Feminar written next to them. And that's where the title of the book comes from. Mm. Yeah. What about you? What have you been reading?
I am actually early to something. We don't do this very often. I know. So I have been reading Really Good, Actually, by Monica Hesse. And I hope that's how you pronounce the surname, because I've only seen it written down and I couldn't find anywhere where anybody had said it aloud. So it's Hesse or Heise. I need to find out, because one of the reasons I read it is I'm interviewing her in January. More on that in a minute. But yeah, so this, you'll have seen this everywhere if you are online already. It has been in like almost every anticipated debut list of 2023, or any anticipated sort of books of 2023 list, including she was on the front of the bookseller and all the rest of it. And it's got the cover of it is like a really close up of a woman's face. So it's her bangs, as they say in Canada. Or like fringe, sort of put swept to each side, fringe, ginger hair, big blue eyes that are like leaking mascara from them. Honestly, if you haven't seen it already, you are going to see it everywhere in January. The big thing about Monica Hesse is that not only is she this like exciting debut author, she is a TV screenwriter, and one of the shows that she worked on was Schitt's Creek, which I'm sure, Kirsty, even you have come across.
I've heard of it, but you know, I've watched one episode.
You would love it. You would love it.
Well, you say that. So many people have said that I will love it, but I watched the first episode of the first series and I found it really irritating, and that's why I've not
so did it. I. So did I. Get past it, because that's okay. The first one where they're all sort of like arseholes, and then they have to go and live in this place and they can't be arseholes for much longer, and it's very queer. So anyway, I'm sure my guest is probably already sick of talking about Schitt's Creek. But her book is really, so it's a good job really, because it's called Really Good Actually, and it's one of those titles, isn't it, even though it's about the way the protagonist says she's feeling. It's one of those titles that's a bit dodgy for reviews if it's not really good actually, but I'm here to tell you it is really good actually. It's about this woman called Maggie, who has been with her boyfriend Joe. I'm just checking that he's called Joe, because actually he rarely appears. So yeah, I think he's called Joe, but I've forgotten, even though I've only read it. Who cares about him? It's all about the women. So they are getting divorced. They've been married for just under 2 years, but we're together. Sorry, he's called John. I will correct myself. Her boyfriend John. They were married for 2 years, but have been together for 10. Mm. And so they've split up. And now she's got to come to terms with being single for the first time in her adult life. Living on her own. She's in the middle of a PhD that's about dead people, basically. It's one of those, you know, with like, she does say what she does for a PhD, but I know this as a PhD student. It doesn't matter how many times you explain to people what you do for your PhD, nobody can remember. Because it's always just some obscure, weird thing. So, so she's doing this PhD. She's got a group of really cool friends. So it takes place over a year after the breakup happens. And basically, as it goes, or at least for like three quarters of it, she gets messier and messier. And not in that, I think part of what's really good about it is because part of me when I say that goes, oh God, there's been so many novels recently about young women who are messy. And but it's, I found it different to that. So partly because she gets more and more distance from her friendship group, and the further it goes on, you realise that she is actually being a bit of a twat. And so there's this sort of this distance appears. And then, without giving too much away what Hesse does, is then strip that away. So things happen that make her realise, actually, so this is a sort of slow burning revelation that actually it might be her that's the problem. And then she has to do something about it. And even though, so I got divorced, I was a decade older than her when I got divorced, but I could relate to lots of the stuff that she did to try and avoid dealing with any of the stuff that it brings up. And like, you know, just that, like, some of it's just the sheer hell of having to deal with things when you've like been in a sort of set routine and whatever. Mm. Anyway, if people who've seen Schitt's Creek will know that Schitt's Creek is very, very funny. And she's also very funny because she's a very funny writer. But so I just wanted to read a bit so you get a sort of taste. So at the end of each chapter, you get things that sort of give you a bit more insight into how Maggie's actually feeling. So you get Google lists of things she's Googled. You get, what else do we get? Emails that she's sent sometimes to companies that are completely deranged, trying to sort stuff out, that either she's bought loads of stuff late at night, or things that are still connected to her ex's account. So it means he's finding out about stuff that she's been doing. So you get all these sorts of bits at the end. And some of the chapters end with a fantasy. And one of the fantasies is like, she's walking home. She's been to spinning class. She looks amazing. She's dewy and glowing. She's walking up the street. And then she notices that her ex is in front. And of course, he's trudging along the street because he's not coping and everything's terrible. And she's trying not to catch up with him so as not to humiliate him. and then they spot each other and this happens. I'm just going to repeat that this is a fantasy story, not what's actually going on in life. So somebody shouts a name. I turn at the same time John does. We both see the man immediately. Can't miss him because of the crowd that's formed. He runs towards us in his massive experimental trousers, smiling and waving. There she is, says Harry Styles, slipping a stylish tattooed arm around my waist. John clocks it immediately. Our easy intimacy, the flush in my cheeks. I feel a flicker of compassion for the man who was once my husband. I want to ask Harry Styles to be a little less familiar, to show some respect for the awkward situation. I want to say, Harry Styles, please. But I know I can't stop him. He's too excited. It's all so new. John's face falls, but he reaches out to shake the hand of the international superstar I met by chance on an airplane and charmed by pretending to be unfamiliar with his discography. Better not, mate, says Harry Styles. I've spent all morning fingering your wife. I did proper laugh out loud when I read that bit, and it wasn't the only bit that I proper laughed at. So that comes out January. It's the 17th of January it comes out. And on the 19th, I'm interviewing her at Waterstones Deansgate in Manchester. It's a fiver for a ticket or £18 if you want a copy of the book. There you go. Look at me doing my spiel. And there's a link on my bio and my Instagram. Or just go to Waterstones site, or go to one of Waterstones Deansgate's socials, and they've got links for tickets. But yes, it should be good fun because she is very funny and a very astute writer. I've got to say, one of the things that I noticed when this arrived was that Lauren Euler's wrote for it. And I interviewed Lauren Euler last year, and she is obviously a very astute critic. She's lovely. I really loved interviewing her. She is very smart. And like, if Lauren Euler's blurbing it, then, you know, that's all you need to know from my perspective.
I have seen this book everywhere already. And I did see that she's doing an event in London with Dolly Alderton that sold out in some ridiculously small amount of time. I have to say, I had mentally put it in the messy girl in her 20s bin, and I just felt like I didn't need that in my life. But you've just made it sound really good, and damn you, because I do not need to be buying more books. Because I really wanted to just consign one to the bin and go, no, that's not for me. I'm 40. I don't need to be reading, you know, more lists of shit people did in their 20s, but that does sound very funny. And I resent you for it.
Unfortunately, Kirsty, some of the things that she does is spend too much time online.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Goes to exercise classes that are horrendous. There's a bit where she goes to one of those. She goes to a spinning class, but it's at one of like horrendous gyms, you know, where it's all dead competitive and it's in dark and they shout at you and stuff. And you know, even the recollection that I ever did, I've never been to spinning class actually, but the stuff that I went to thinking that it was going to change my life, and I'm just like,
oh god, I've been there. I went to three spinning classes, the first one of which, and I'd never been, and I went to a beginner's spin class. I mean, Jesus, it was awful. And the worst bit was, in retrospect, the fact that it was at the gym that was in the basement of my then workplace.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all colleagues.
Oh, no.
Or like, not even colleagues that you know well, like people that you know to kind of do the half smile at in the corridor. Mm. and then suddenly you're just, and whenever I get hot or out of breath or, you know, whatever, my face goes absolutely scarlet. No light dewy glow for me. I go fully like foghorn in the mist, just flashing away. And firstly, I did the classic, couldn't get my feet out the stirrups. So after the spin class, which I nearly expired in, I just had to sit on the bike for a minute because I couldn't get my feet out. And then the pain in my thighs was such that, not that day, but like the next day and the day after, I could barely walk. I could barely walk. It wasn't a bit sore. I had to go to London. I wasn't working in London at the time. I had to go to London for a meeting. And when the person I was there to meet said, oh, we'll just go up these stairs, I nearly cried. Because I had to do that thing of clinging to the handrails without showing that I was clinging to the hand. I was bad. It was really bad, but very happily for me, on a number of levels. I found out I was pregnant with my daughter about 3 weeks later, and my doctor went, I wouldn't take up any new strenuous exercise at all. I can't go back to my new spin class then. Devastated. And she's 11 next month and I've still not gone back. So.
Well,
there's my spinning story for you.
That's not quite how this spin class goes, but believe me, you will find much of this relatable because I did. So, yeah, there we go.
Oh, dear. Anyway, so last of the series again.
Mm.
That time again. And we... So we decided to end on a couple of, basically just weird books.
Hmm.
Which was the reason we put them together. The two books we're going to be talking about are Plain Bad Heroines by Emily M. Danforth, which was published by Borough Press in, was it 2000? Yeah, 2020. Yes, it was, because I bought it during lockdown, I remember. It was one of the many online events that was happening at that point. And then the other book, I reiterate my sincere apologies to Anna McLaughlin, who I hope will listen to this. Anna sent me The Proof of the Dollmaker by Nina Allen in late 2018. It was published in April 2019 by River Run, which is part of Quercus. I've only just read it. But without wanting to go too spoiler alert, it was worth the wait. But we're first going to talk about Plain Bad Heroines. Now, I was really looking forward to this book. I bought it in hardback. In fact, I pre-ordered it in hardback. That's how much I was looking forward to it, because on the face of it, this ticks basically all of my boxes. We've got horror. We've got gothic. One moment, there's my son. We've got 19, it's mainly set in 1902, or a big part of it set in 1902. It's absolutely full of lesbians. It's weird. It's got an incredible cover. Like, this is like every box ticked. Oh, it's not very good though, is it?
Oh, that was straight in, Kirsty.
Oh, just really wanted to love it and I didn't, and I feel really bad.
Me neither. It took me ages to read it, and although it doesn't tick my boxes in quite the same as you, I started it and went, oh, it's metafictional, I love metafiction, and it just didn't work. So yeah, there were things about it that were good and that I enjoyed, but yeah.
I feel like, I mean, I didn't mean to be quite as harsh as that, and it's not that I it's not like I was sitting there resenting every page, but I did. It's too long. Like, it is too long. It's over 600 pages. My hardback, my very big hardback, 623 pages. And there were, you know, there were bits of it that I did like. It's just as a whole thing, there's just, it just sort of doesn't hang together, and there's just too much of it. And actually, and we can talk about this, it's a dual narrative. So it's partly set in 1902, as I said, at a boarding school called Brick Haunts, out in the middle of nowhere. And right at the beginning, we find out that these two girls, Clara and Florence, have died in this horrific accident. I don't know if that's the right word. Basically, they've been stung to death by a load of these yellow jacket wasps, which are horrible things and are a motif that recur throughout the book. The girls were part of the Plain Bad Heroine Society, which is a kind of group that they've set up based around a book that they've been reading and they've all got really obsessed with. And then the head teacher, who's Libby Brickhaunce, and her partner, Alexandra Trills, they're sort of trying to get to the root of what this book is, and all this stuff comes out and blah, blah, blah. But also, parallel to this, there's the kind of modern day, which is a book has been written about the Brickhaunce stuff. And now a film is being made of that book, and it the kind of modern day storyline centers around Merritt, who's the author of the book, the ridiculously named actress Harper Harper, who is meant to be starring in the film, and another person who's also going to be in the film, Audrey. So they're trying to make the film based on it, and it all goes very strange. But yeah, as a dual narrative, I know you felt the opposite to me. I just wanted to get rid of all the modern stuff. I couldn't care less about the modern stuff. I just wanted the big Victorian ghost story, basically.
Yeah, so we were discussing this before, because I knew that that was your preferred bit. So the problem, I'm saying this from like a writing perspective, that the problem with writing a dual narrative is they have to be connected to each other like really strongly, which I sort of felt these weren't connected strongly, even though they're making the film based on it. I felt like they could have reduced it actually to like, this is the little bit you need to know for this bit to work. Like, you could have stripped out loads actually of the 1902 stuff. Yeah, and what happens is, as a reader, you favour one side or the other. So I would have got rid of all the historical stuff and kept the modern stuff. But the modern stuff didn't quite work for me, because so my big thing, so that, like I've already said, the thing that I thought I was going to love the most about this was the metafictional stuff, which I didn't know was going to be in there. So I sort of came into this a bit blind, even though it was one of those I'd seen it about, I'd thought it like it'd be, you know, a good read or whatever. Fun, whatever, and bits of it were, but when I saw that it was metafictional, I was like, oh yes. So we get this book that's been written by this woman that all the girls are carrying around and using as a like talisman type thing, and a guidebook to some sort of weird life, and then we've got the 1902 story, which Merritt's written a book about, and it seems like towards the end that what we've been doing is reading Merritt's book about that time, although that's sort of vaguishly mentioned at the end. Then we've got obviously this film that's being made about it. Then it gets more metafictional, because Audrey gets told by the director that what he's actually going to do is film this like Blair Witch type thing. So the cameras are going to be rolling like almost all the time, filming all the other stuff between them, because they know there's a really like dodgy dynamic between the three of them, because Merritt's a bit bitchy with Audrey. She doesn't think she's right for the part of Clara and blah, blah, blah. And she's like been on a date with Harper and snogged her and whatever. So there's that sort of dynamic going on. And then Merritt starts writing a book because she's stuck on the book she's writing. So then she starts writing a book about the filming of filming of the book that she wrote. Like, you know, and there's a point where that sort of collapses because there is too much of it going on. And the whole thing with metafiction is that you're drawing attention to the fact that what you're doing is fiction. But if you do it really well and pull it off, which we will discuss when we talk about the next book, you actually... you still believe in what's happening. And I didn't believe any of it. I wasn't scared. I didn't find the horror scary because I didn't believe, like, the stuff for the yellow jackets just didn't feel like
I did get slightly to the point of going, those fucking wasps again, like, just,
yeah. Well, it's that thing about things don't need to be possible, but they need to be plausible within the world that you've created, and I don't think they are. So the bits actually that bothered me the most, and this wasn't necessarily, well, the bits that I found the most scariest, I'm putting that in inverted quotes like a dickhead, but there we are, was all the stuff around consent and then being filmed and what was being filmed and the way they were being set up. That was the bit for me that was horrifying more than anything else, which, and this becomes a sort of Me Too narrative to an extent, about what control they have about what's being filmed and what's being shown. And there's a whole thing with Audrey's mum is also a, like, B-list horror actress who was in some, like, cult film, this film that's become a cult film. And she ended up, she was an alcoholic once, she, and she had this accident where she basically, like, crashed into someone's garden and it was filmed. And she's almost as famous for that as she is for the film that she made. So Audrey's grown up with, like, knowing about that invasion of privacy and what have you. So there's stuff around that. But even that don't feel like it came to any sort of proper conclusion for me. So
no, none of it did. Like, I feel like it was a book that had loads of good ideas, but sort of didn't quite come through on really any of them. I mean, what I did like, and I'm not going to go into it for spoiler reasons, but the bit I actually liked was the explanation, like the backstory of the school, and actually what was at the root of all the kind of haunting and weirdness. Like, I liked that. That was sort of more in your classic gothic novel sort of territory. But that, yeah, like, if they just, I feel like if she just kind of concentrated on one thread, or and just written two books. I feel like it was two books. Do you know what I mean? Like, we both read, and we obviously wanted to read different books. And I feel like we could have done that. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, you know, here are the things I liked about it. It was full of horror references. I didn't find it scary in and of itself, but you know, I liked the horror references. There was, you know, references to loads of Stephen King and Peter Straub and you know, Blair Witch Project and
The Omen
and Shirley Jackson, and obviously the author loves Shirley Jackson. I mean, I feel like, I mean, it's partly set in California, which is of course where Shirley Jackson's from, but, and then partly set in Providence, Rhode Island, which is where H.P. Lovecraft was born. I mean, we also have referenced the fact he was a massive racist, so that is noted as well. But yeah, so I love all those sort of nods to the history of horror and the history of American horror particularly. But yeah, I feel guilty. I feel bad. I really, really wanted to love it. I was even like pleased that we were saving this for the last week. So I was like, oh, something to look forward to. And it'll be a really easy read and I'm just going to whiz through it. And it took me nearly a week. Yeah, it's just very big. It's very long.
I think that's partly why it's disappointing, though, is because we were looking forward to it. And it's that thing, isn't it, when you've got expectations for a book that aren't pulled out. I tell you, I did enjoy the fact that it was so queer and that she
did. Yeah, I did.
Historical stuff. The other thing I really enjoyed was the lack of men.
Oh, a joy. It's like the reverse Bechdel test.
Yeah. And when there was a man in there, like at least two of them were queer. And the only one who was sort of even vaguely prominent in it was Burr, the director, who then that whole thing I found a bit odd, because basically when this is a bit of a spoiler, but at the point when the film has come out, which is right at the end of the book, he shows him. So in the way he's edited the footage where he's filmed him, like outside of the actual film itself, he's shown himself up to be the villain, to be the person who's pulling all the strings.
Mm.
Which is a bit of that, like, man trying to, like, reclaim the Me Too. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's taking
attention away again, and I'm just like, oh, eye roll.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I've got to say, when it came to them meeting the director, I was like, why is it not a female director? Was the first thing in my head. And so and that was why it was sort of a, like, plot thing, because it wouldn't have played out that way. But I do wonder if having a female director and then having all the stuff that went wrong, I'm putting that in air quotes like a dickhead as well, it would have been more believable, because then it became obvious that it was Burr pulling the strings with most, if not all, of that.
Whereas
if it had been a woman and it hadn't been that thing about consent, whether that would have played out differently and would have been more convincing from a horror perspective.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think this is the kind of book where its queerness will have sold it to a lot of people, mm-hmm. particularly younger people. And also, I mean, bear in mind that Emily Danforth wrote The Miseducation of Cameron Post, I think that's the name of it, which was a YA novel that was made into a film that was, you know, quite big. And this isn't a YA book, but it's not far off it, actually. Mm-hmm. But I think the queerness is probably the most interesting thing about it.
Hmm.
But it does, I would say, I mean, it's the, do you know what, if I'd read it when I was 18, I would have loved it. Like, I would have, and I would have gone, I would have felt really clever for, like, spotting the references. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I did not read it when I was 18. I read it when I was 40. And I would suggest that was perhaps too late.
Yeah, isn't it interesting? I mean, we've read recently that we feel like we've aged out, like we're getting old, Kirsty. We're just gonna face it.
That's all right. We can read the Monica Hassey. Apparently, that's all right.
Well, the thing is, it's that thing, isn't it? I think if somebody's done it well and they're talking about, it's that universal truth thing, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's, you know, universal truths are universal, obviously, by the nature. But cover's great.
The cover's excellent. It's very bright.
Very good cover. And I feel like we're probably in the minority. I've seen some rapturous reviews of this book. So maybe it's just us.
Maybe it is.
Should we talk about a book that we both loved?
Oh my God, yes.
The other end of the scale then, The Dollmaker by Nina Allen. Oh, it's so good. It's such a good book. And I'm so happy that we're finishing on this one. We are going out on a high. And again, Anna, I'm so sorry. I've had this proof for so long, but it was so worth the wait. It's a weird little book. It's about a man called Andrew Garvey, who is a doll maker. He's been obsessed with dolls his whole life. He's a doll maker, and he has been keeping up a correspondence with a lady called Bramber, who is, it becomes apparent, in an institution or a hospital in the middle of nowhere in Bodmin, down in Devon. And Andrew, who's in London, decides that it is his great mission to go and rescue Bramber because he loves her, and he's going to go and rescue her from the institution and bring her back. And she loves dolls as well. And one of the things they start writing to each other about is another doll maker called Eva Chaplin, who also has written stories. And so we have this novel that is made up of various different things. It is Andrew talking about his own life and his sort of slightly madcap road trip down to Devon to find Bramber. It is the letters, it's one side of the correspondence between Andrew and Bramber. It's Bramber's letters to Andrew, in which we find out more about her own backstory, how she's ended up in the institution, and her fascination with dolls. And then you used the word audacious earlier when we were talking mm-hmm. earlier, and I'm going to steal that word. That interspersed throughout are short stories by Eva Chaplin, who has been that have been translated, quote unquote, into English, and is the book that Andrew is reading while he's on his way to Bramber. But it's weird, and in a way that Plain Bad Herons was in no way scary. Some of this I found genuinely quite frightening, very disconcerting, very sort of out of time in places, out of place. Names crop up, you know, there's weird similarities between the stories and real life. It's just there's so much going on. But I know you love this book, and I also know that it has a certain amount of crossover with what you've been doing for your PhD. So I'm just gonna go, right, Naomi, on you go. The floor is yours. Take it away.
Well, I have to say before I start that you talked about loving it in the 84. So this is the 84th book we've done for this podcast. And this
bloody
is
hell, is it?
Yeah, I counted God. Deliberately. And this is my favorite book that we have done by some way. So there are other books that I've loved. Wow. But this is the most me book we have even come close to looking at. And it was that thing that, like, I've also had a copy for ages because Anna sent me a copy, although mine's a finished one. And I'm like, part of me was like, I wish I'd bloody picked this up like ages ago. But also, it was such a nice one. So we're going to have a bit of a break after this because my thesis needs to be submitted because I've been dicking about for too long. But it's the perfect one to do because, like you said, there's some crossover with some of the stuff that I'm writing about. To the point that, so the first story that we read from Eva Chaplin, but the first story is called The Duchess, which I loved. I'll say why I loved it particularly in a second. But got to the like third page of this, and Nellie, who's the main character, goes to see this man that she's known her entire life because he's a friend of her father's, and he's called Konrad Binowski. And at that point, I stopped because I was like, I know that surname. That surname is the surname of the family in Geek Love. And then there's another character called Iphigenia, and one of the conjoined twins is called Iffy in there. And the story, and this is something that you didn't mention because it's not revealed about Andrew until quite a way through, but Andrew's a dwarf. And in almost every of the Eva Chapman stories, there is a dwarf. They're all treated in different ways. So the whole thing about Geek Love, so I just want to put in here, because people will go, oh God, you like Geek Love, because there's a whole discussion, an academic discussion as well as a sort of more informal one, about whether Geek Love is ableist. And I mean, essentially, yes, because the whole plot's about the fact that these parents basically create disabled children to put them in their own freak show. And,
right. You
know, so yes, on that level, yes. But also I think what she's doing in that book is critiquing freak shows and capitalism and the patriarchy. Like, there's all sorts going on in that book, which is one of the reasons that I love it. But anyway, when I got to that bit and I was like, oh my God, reference points that I knew, I was like so geekly excited that I texted you, and I think it was quite late on Friday night as well. Yeah, anyway, I'm just gibbering absolute nonsense now because I loved it. But yes, I'd said that this use of short stories is audacious. So she pulls off the metafiction in a way that doesn't happen in the other book. So one of the things about that was like the fact that these short stories are, you could read those stories on their own and they're satisfying. You can tell that happily. I love it because I'm talking so fast now. I'm really aware that I'm like, whoa! Yeah, the short stories are really satisfying on their own. But like you said, a link to, and that's what you've got. If you're going to keep your readers' interest, you've got to link them. And she sort of does it in a way where, like you said, Andrew points out that characters have got similar names or they're similar circumstances. And then as you get towards the end, it's not as clear and you're sort of having to make the links for yourself, which I thought was quite nice that she sort of guided the reader to start with and then off you go on your own. And that first story I said that I particularly enjoyed, she does this a couple of times where you think you know where it's going and then she wrong foots you right at the end, but in a way that is still really satisfying and possibly more satisfying because it's not ended up. So the first one I thought it was going to end up in a sort of fairly straightforward trajectory, and then she flips the end so well that I was like, that's a much better ending than it would have been. So like just so clever, but not like, I also felt that, so Andrew and Bramber, I was rooting for him, and like I said about playing bad heroines, that the point of like the whole thing about metafiction is you're drawing attention to the fact that it's fictional, but actually I believed in Andrew and Bramber. She did it so well that I believed in his quest, I believed that he was going to meet her, I believed in her. She pulls it off so brilliantly. I'm a bit of a spoiler here, but because you think, because he's sort of going to rescue her, but in the end she rescues herself, which again is that twist that's even more satisfying than it would have been. And I had that emotional connection with those characters, like I'd invested in them so much that I believed in their journey and what they were doing and how, and I wanted to know how it ended. And yeah, sorry, I've rabbited now.
No, I've loved it. I mean, it's yes, all of that. And actually the drawing the connections becomes part of the fun of the novel, because once you realise that that's what she's doing and that these names, you know, these names keep cropping up, there's various versions of Andrew and there's various things that sound a bit like Bramber, and there's Amber and Ambergris, and it turns up in all these different stories. You know, you start wondering what the next connection is going to be, and you start sort of trying to look forward going, oh, I wonder if that's going to turn up. And, you know, in so many of the cases they do, and things get kind of reflected in different ways, which is just, and it's so cleverly done. Like, it would be so easy to completely bugger this up. Like, if you didn't know what you were doing, you could so easily completely cock it up. And she doesn't. She's so completely in command of it all the way through, but in a way that still makes it really readable. You know, it doesn't feel like you're reading something that's clearly, I can't imagine what her, I don't know if she does post-it notes or what, but like I can't imagine what her like plotting wall looks like, you know, the kind of all the various links and names and things, but she does it in such a way that it doesn't feel like a chore to the reader, which is a real skill, I think.
Yeah, I wonder if also because prior to this she wrote quite a lot of science fiction, like sort of pure, well, because this is magical realism really, I would say, but she wrote sort of pure science fiction before that, and I wonder if that's helped with the plotting in that like science fiction novels are often quite intricate. The other thing that I would say, because I mentioned Geek Love and the sort of controversy around Geek Love and what it's actually about, and I think one of the things that Alan does really well, because she addresses that fact about dwarves and how they're often, because there's the whole thing in there about pausing dwarves and how they're seen, and she starts off in the first story about a painting that's got a dwarf in it and a queen, and she talks about how actually dwarves were often the queen's lovers because they were bored when the kings were off, and that's what they got up to because nobody ever suspected the dwarves. And she gives such, it's what she does is give such different portraits, because there is in the second story a dwarf who's clearly quite sort of malicious, but in a in a very sort of not placid, but almost that like under the surface, like there's all sorts going on in that story. But she gives such a sort of range of characters. So in the institution that Bramber's in as well, one of her friends, two of her friends actually, were a couple. are dwarves, and they talk about they can't go out to the circus because they'd keep them there, and so she addresses all these things within it, and shows, and like doesn't even mention for ages that Andrew's a dwarf, so you're reading it and understanding him as a person before she even mentions, and Bramber doesn't know until she meets him, she's never told. It's like she brings out the humanity and all the different ways that people behave within these characters that are also dwarves, and I thought she did that brilliantly. Actually, it's so sort of much subtly done, I think.
Yeah, because there's all these recurring motifs. So of course we see dwarves in nearly every sort of timeline or story. Queens, I mean, you could argue, I think, that Bramber is the queen to Andrew's dwarf. Lots of queens, lots of amber, whether that's the substance turns up as well as characters named Amber, and then obviously the dolls themselves. I mean, the book's called The Doll Maker. These dolls appear in basically every story, and they kind of function in lots of different ways. And what it felt like to me she was doing, as well as kind of showing all those different aspects of people, but also how this sort of otherworldly, sort of fairy tale, kind of Eastern European Brothers Grimm type stuff, how that looks in real life in a way. Do you know what I mean? It was the real life versions of these sort of quite timeless, and I mean timeless in two ways, both without time and of all time, sort of fairy tale stuff. I tell you what, it kind of sort of, some of it tonally reminded me, and not just because it's dolls, was The Doll's Alphabet by Camilla Gradova.
Mm.
Of some of those sorts of Eastern European inflected, could be set in any time,
yeah,
type stories.
Yeah, and even like, so the Andrew Bramber stories meant to be set sort of now, or like, you know, 2018 or whenever it came out, because he's got a mobile phone, and there's this whole thing about it for a while he doesn't realize that Bramber's in an institution but he's confused about the fact she doesn't have a mobile phone. So it does give it that sort of like weird quality of sometimes you're not quite sure which, and of course with the dolls as well, because they are like, one of the things that I loved was the fact that, so he gets really well known, so he has an agent called Clarence, who's his agent, because he gets really well known for these troll dolls, as they're called. Which I had to have a minute whilst I'm like where does she explain this, because all I could think of was those horrific like hairy
the trolls with the hair stuff.
I was a teenager, but still. And so he had started collecting dolls that were essentially worthless, that, you know, he's ended up paying more for than the person who was selling them expected, because they were broken in some way, but obviously far less than, you know, they would have been worth originally. And he's created these dolls that have got disfigurements in them, essentially, and they sell for like thousands of pounds to collectors who love this sort of thing, but they all sound like they're a little bit freaky because of it, which I thought was that interesting thing about disability and horror and villains, and it's like she plays on that quite a lot through it, I thought.
Yeah, definitely. She's now one of those writers that I'm immediately like, now I need to read everything she's written.
Yeah, I've got the novel she wrote after this, and I think I've got one of her science fiction ones as well. But yeah, I was basically, like I said to you, I got a few pages in and was like, holy shit, we've got all the same interest. This book was basically written for me. What was I going to say as well? I absolutely loved the short stories as well. They were so fucking weird. And had just mad people in them, like, so they're, and I don't mean that in the sense that of Bramber being an institution, it was not in an institution for any of the reasons that she should be, like, that came out wrong, didn't it? All the reasons that she's been placed in the institutions are not reasons you should be in an institution.
Yeah,
anyway.
But
yeah, I particularly enjoyed the one, I'll not be able to find it now because I haven't even marked anything. I was so into it I've turned one page over with a sentence in that I really loved, but otherwise I was just lost in it. The one with Aunt Lola in, which is called Happenstance. And I was it's about this young woman who goes to stay with Aunt Lola while she takes this job as a makeup artist because she doesn't pay much. And Aunt Lola's a crime writer. And let's just say that some of Aunt Lola's stories end up crossing into real life. And that is weird. But again, that's that thing when you talked about the Eastern European thing, that she's in this big old-fashioned apartment and it has that sort of sense of she's got film stars on the wall. And yeah, it very much had that sort of noir sense.
Totally. I thought it was really interesting reading the acknowledgements for the book, actually, that a couple of those stories had appeared in their own right, like as published short stories. And I thought it was really interesting that she's taken something that was obviously written as a short story and published as a standalone short story and then inserted it into this much bigger novel.
You're making an assumption there, Kirsty. That might not be correct. She could have written it for the novel and put it in as a short story.
That's true.
Could have done it the other way around.
She could have done.
I'm only partly thinking about that because I know from having interviewed her that Sarah Hall often writes short stories alongside novels that she's writing to try and work things out. So Mrs. Fox was written alongside The Wolf Border. And then obviously it's been a like most successful short story on its own. So yeah, so it might be the other way around. Actually, I quite like, I was thinking yesterday actually that we haven't added anybody to our little group of like women we'd like to hang out with. And I'm very
Nina Allen's in there. Absolutely. I just think it says a different version of, so I guess it's either that or she's taken the stories and she's changed them to fit into the novel.
Be interesting to know.
That would be interesting to know. I would like to know the answer to that.
Can I read my favourite sentence as well? Only because, right, my favourite sentences in books are always sweary ones. But this is in the Aunt Lola story.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think she's called Sophie, isn't she? The writer. So she's met this guy called Will who works on film, is a writer, and he's working on a prison break drama, which she's ended up working on as well. And it says, he had spent 6 months working alongside the celebrity criminal who still got to take most of the scripting credit in spite of, and these are Will's words, not mine, not being able to string a sentence together that did not include the word cunt. And I thoroughly enjoyed that sentence.
One of my favourites was in what was probably actually my favourite of the short stories, which is called Amber Furnace. I think it's the second one, where the dwarf in that story is called Anders, and the queen, I suppose, is Amber, who they've struck up this sort of friendship, certainly platonic on her side. Where she's ended up sort of living in he's got a spare room and she's sort of moved in as a lodger. But his house and his shop that he runs is full of clocks and all the clocks are running at different times. So there's this odd sort of discombobulating ticking all the time. And this is quite near the beginning of the story. And she says, I love your clocks, she said, they're mesmerizing. I've always been in love with the idea of time. He fell silent for a moment, gazing around the room. It's interesting how it fascinates, is it not? The simple arrangement of numbers around a dial. Some people think it's their symmetry that makes time's pieces so appealing, but I've always believed it's because they are alive. Alive? I mean, they have a function beyond being decorative. They do something. Having a clock in the room is almost like having company. And I love that idea of time and a clock being company. That they're alive somehow it's relevant for the rest of that story because it does become about time and what time is, and there's lots of references throughout the book to time as this kind of artificial construct essentially that was invented by humans to stop themselves going insane. And I find that whole thing fascinating, really, but I do keep thinking now about but as clocks as company.
Yeah, I just think the whole book's delicious. That's my word for it.
It is.
Gobbled it up.
Yep. Ending on a high.
Yep, absolutely. I can't say what we're doing next week because there is no next week, not yet anyway.
No, but we will be back.
We will, probably late spring. We've got to take a bit of a break so I can finish my thesis. I wince every time I say that. I'm just like, oh, Christ.
Will Naomi ever be able to read another book again? We simply don't know.
Might be the end, yeah. Oh, dear. However, in the meantime, you can still follow us.
You can.
Wherever you get, subscribe to us.
I'm not doing a PhD.
Well, you can go back and listen to any episodes you've missed because they're all there. You can follow Kirsty on Twitter at The Other Kirsty, promoting her books because there's lots of exciting things coming out from Atlantic next year. The plug there.
Thank you.
And also on Instagram at Other Kirsty.
No, the.
Yep. I'm on Instagram, but I'm going to disappear. So you might catch me if you're quick at Naomi Frisbee, or see me in Manchester with Monica Hesse in January. Otherwise, we will be back later in the year.
Or next year.
Yes. Oh, God. I keep forgetting because I don't really do Christmas because I don't like it for reasons that we'll not go into on here that I have just tuned out of this year. I haven't got anything. I haven't got a tree up, nothing. My house is Christmas free. And I'm just like, everybody keeps going on about breaking up and whatever. And I'm like, what's going on?
So yes, you're already in 2023.
I am timeless, Kirsty. I'm in suspended animation until this fucking thesis is finished. So yes, we will see you at some point in 2023. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.